You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living. I'm not even going to finish that, because this is episode 22. It's a sequel to episode 20. Go listen to episode 21st, before this. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer, calling in from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allen in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey in Annapolis, Maryland.
Yeah, so we reconvened the whole group from episode 20 so long ago because we were discussing pragmatism, William James, and we felt that we were kind of rushed, that there was a lot of sections of that book, Pragmatism, that we did not talk about his specifics, and it just seemed a very important topic, and we would probably have some more fun with it if we came in here and let our mouths flow. However, we did read one new thing, which was The Will to Believe, an essay by him from before pragmatism. 1896. Pragmatism was 1907. So it does not use the word pragmatism in it, I don't believe. At least it does not play an important part in it, and it is not essentially tied, I think, to the pragmatic conception, but it goes well with it, obviously, since it's the same dude, and it seemed necessary, given how pragmatism, the book, the series of lectures, sold itself as being a way to reconcile hard-nosed empiricists to belief in religion, or at least the acceptability of someone else's belief in religion, or accepting the possibility that faith could be a rational choice, but yet it didn't really seem to pay off. It did have a chapter near the end that where it talked about religion, but there's definitely something in a Will to Believe essay that was missing from the later pragmatism lecture. Should we start with the new material or talk more about truth or talk about irrelevant things like soccer?
Soccer.
We could talk about why you think soccer is irrelevant when it explains the world.
What is the pragmatic way to play soccer?
I want to talk about whether my laugh really sounds like that Simpsons character.
Dr. Hibbert?
Yeah. Because that's kind of an insincere laugh, right? That's just, and it's also like this disavowal laugh where something terrible is going on and then he laughs, right?
I thought it was just because he was...
You have cancer.
I thought it was because he was a buffoon. It was not because it was insincere.
Well, he's also a buffoon. The mismatch between his laugh and the situation comes from a kind of cluelessness. You're right.
And it's much more baritone.
Yeah, it's not as nice.
I would say that the person who made that comment about your laugh was misinterpreting his qualia.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Let's not get into that.
Yes. Hey, if you want links to these readings, you should go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. We have been posting many a thing at partiallyexaminedlife.com, including, if you were a fan of our last episode on philosophy of mind, a bunch of videos of actual professional philosophers talking about these philosophy of mind issues with some commentary and sniping by at least me and Wes and some other people. So go check it out. And then we can talk about Dan Dennett as a pragmatist this entire episode.
Does he consider himself a pragmatist?
Maybe. Wittgensteinian. Wittgenstein is sort of a pragmatist. Yeah. Is Quine thought of as a pragmatist?
Yeah, I think he has some criticisms of classical pragmatism, but there are some pragmatist streaks, something like that.
Yes. I was just, as I was going through YouTube videos, I was watching some video of Quine from, I don't know, the 60s or 70s. They had very old-looking shirts.
Therefore, he cannot be taken seriously.
And it was an interesting interview with him, and he was an avowed behaviorist, seemingly. Really thought that mental talk was all not useful, and was a hardcore physicalist. So take that for what it is. Name-dropping.
Yes. I'm likely to get upset if we follow down that path.
Me too.
All right, the law is no getting Seth upset.
What is the law? Do you remember that? Is it the island of Dr. Moreau?
Mm-mm.
Yeah. Like, what is the law? We walks on 2 feet. So he's trying to turn the animals into human beings or something like that. Never mind.
Who plays the doctor in that?
Well, in the remake, it was...
Brando, right?
Brando. No. Yeah.
Was, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I thought that was... Speaking of pop culture references, after reading The Will to Believe, I thought of the Rush song where, you know, Free Will?
Sure.
No. Anyway.
No.
You know, if you choose
thing.
Not to decide, you still have made a choice. So I was hoping Mark would put in a little clip from that, although I guess that's illegal, right?
Except he's a... Neil Peart is an objectivist.
Right, I know.
I will choose the path that's clear. I will choose free will.
Yeah, they mean it in a different way. Where, yeah.
A different, crazier way.
Yeah, yeah. How I wouldn't call them pluralists. Yeah. Or like Ayn Randians.
So send your hate mail. Post it to the Facebook page. And we have a whole thread ripping on Rand over and over and over and over again by a number of people.
Care of Geddy Lee. So basically what it comes down to is you want facts and religion, right? Facts and faith?
That's what he says.
Well, I think it's more than that. I mean, wouldn't he say that the disposition with respect to facts is that it's because we are capable of believing in them that we can have facts at all?
Wow, that was deep and quick. Dylan, you went straight there.
Well, I wouldn't say facts. I would say truths.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a good distinction. To the extent that there are facts, there are things that you associate the character of truth with. And that would be maybe a sort of a special class of things in the sense that they're less disputable or whatever.
Yeah, I think, you know, he wants to say that to get to our truths, we have to brush up against realities, right? There's a reality out there. And there's an agreement between truths and reality. It's just that that agreement is predicated on something else in correspondence. It's predicated on this sort of functional relationship that we have to that reality, which ultimately ends up being a pragmatic relationship. But yeah, I think the point is that the truth is a property of beliefs, and there's no beliefs without believers. So in a way, it doesn't really make sense to talk of some abstract truth independent of the activities and the interests of believers.
Very nice.
But, I mean, he wants to emphasize that, I mean, there's part of this that's a psychological argument, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is trying to avoid the problem of, you know, establishing, I mean, the correspondence, to the extent that it's correspondence because we want that to be that way. This is sort of where he falls into sort of the desirability business. That, well, you know, the way we want to interact with the world is that for a lot of things, we want it to be as much as possible something like what the world is. And yeah, we'll bracket the fact that it isn't exactly that way. But for a lot of things, that we'll just say that, well, when I see a chair, I experience it as a chair. And there's the sort of complicated interrelation between what I see there and what I extrapolate it into saying that it's a chair. And for a pragmatist, it seems to me that that sort of thing a pragmatist finds interesting, but not all that worrisome. There's a lot about pragmatism that it just doesn't get its pants all in a bunch. That's sort of their big criticism a pragmatist would have of like a lot of metaphysics and stuff like that, whether it be extreme skepticism or hardcore foundationalism and stuff like that, is that you just have your pants all in a bunch. Just relax.
All right. So Dylan brings up a good point. Like last time we were kind of like, well, is this really a theory or is this just kind of like the dope smoker's version of, you know, of truth? And I want to at least try to give some credit to this, or there seems to be this motivation, at least in James, where he's arguing against or he's trying to come up with a way to salvage something. Really, the motivation behind the pragmatic theory of truth or the attempt to reconcile religion and truth or religion and is that he's trying to salvage beliefs that can't in some way, shape, or form be verified or validated or made true or instantiated, whatever the case may be. So pick your conventional theory of truth, you know, to believe that God is good versus to believe that you're sitting in a chair. They're two very different things. And it seems that he's basically just trying to find a way to come up with a theory of truth or come up with some way of reconciling those two things. And the reality of the situation is that truth in itself is kind of irrelevant, by which I mean to say something's true or not true, verifiable or not verifiable, is a kind of underhanded way of saying that it has meaning or it doesn't have meaning.
Exactly.
And so what he really wants to be able to do is come up with a systematic way of being able to say that religious beliefs have meaning in the same way that our beliefs about mundane factual things that we theoretically can verify and what have you have meaning. That to me is really what the whole enterprise is motivated by.
This is a good time, though, to make a distinction between his pluralism about religion and his view about, let's say, empirical or scientific truth. Because I think there is a difference. You know, even though we're talking about
pragmatic truth in relation to, let's say, the empirical, we're bumping up against these mind-independent realities, which, you know, he's very adamant about talking about those realities because he doesn't want to be accused of subjectivism. But in religion, criterion changes, right? Criterion becomes purely internal in a sense. And I think this is where we got into some discussion last time where there's some seeming inconsistency with him talking about this is true for me. Well, I think that true for me applies only in the case of, let's say, religion. There's no simply true for me in the case of empirical truth because it rests upon agreement. You know, he talks frequently about agreement as well being a criterion of truth. And that agreement sort of falls out of the picture in religion. It's pluralistic. We don't have to agree about what religious sentiments are going to serve our purposes.
But along the lines of the kinds of things he wants out of scientific truth, I think he would say that part of the way at least individual religions or individuals have those religious conversations depends on a kind of consistency. Maybe it has certain kinds of different logical rules, but I would guess most of them are basically the same and that they demand a kind of consistency. It's not ad hoc in the religious
case.
No,
it's not. It's bumping up against something, but what it's bumping up against is internal, right? It's psychological. So as opposed to mind-independent realities that it's bumping up against, it has something to do with, yeah, I think internal consistency is part of it, internal needs, and yeah, maybe those are common to all human beings. The extent to which it'll be pluralistic or something that's common in virtue of human nature, let's say, I think is an open question.
You know, he focuses on this question of religion, I think, in not knowing a lot about it, but in large part because of the context of the time, and that this question of religion was very, very topical in the late 19th century with sort of an onslaught of hardcore positivism and stuff like that. Mm. But when in reading through it, in this whole notion of the will to believe, even without going where I wanted to go at the beginning with extrapolating it just towards that's the way it is with everything, it seems he could have been talking about lots of other things that are maybe in some ways even more personal and maybe less inflammatory. Just like, you know, being in love, that the characteristic of knowing that you're in love with somebody is going to be, they have the same kind of features.
Say more about that. How can you be sure that you're in love? Well, sort of deciding is part of what makes it the case.
Yeah, I mean, that being in love, that loving your children, loving your wife, that act, that characteristic has a lot in common with religion. I mean, and I wouldn't be the only person ever to say such a thing, right?
Yeah, but I think that's relates to his forced option, right? Where, you know, that's that if you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice thing, where he talks about the man who, if he hesitates indefinitely to ask a certain woman to marry him because he was not perfectly sure that she would prove an angel after he brought her home.
Yes, yes.
Cuts himself off from that particular... I love this angel possibility with a dash, angel dash possibility as decisively as if he went and married someone else. So yeah.
I had forgotten about that part. I don't know how I could have forgotten about that. So he sort of puts it as a possibility there that those acts of human relations that aren't strictly empirical involve a lot of these sorts of things. So the activity of knowing about those relations and the activity of extracting meaning out of those relations, to use Seth's good word, comes from an act of believing. And that believing is going to then be inherently linked to the desirability, that it's just better to believe in it because it makes all sorts of other things.
And even that, it's a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, right? You can't, in many cases, get what you want without believing first.
So. Yeah, and the thing about this is that this kind of thing isn't new. I mean, Socrates talks about this in, I think it's in the Meno. You know, he's being pushed to the wall about whether you know something first or whether you have to learn it, and on and on. And he, maybe it's in the Apology. He says that at the end of the day, he knows it's better to understand that I do not know everything, and that that's a better way to live.
Yeah.
And even the way he says it, it's an act of belief that you do this, that you face, it's an act of bravery that you say that you can know things, and that you that knowing is better than not, and that all these sort of mental actions are at the end done because it makes your life better to do it than not to do it.
Of course, if you're feeling snide about it, maybe a better analogy between religious belief and your falling in love with your future partner or whatever is religious belief and my love for Reese Witherspoon.
Or, well,
I, in other words, something.
What?
Yeah, but I mean, you can demote all kinds of feelings of connection that person has. You know, whether it be to some notion of religious belief that you want to call God or that you want to say that it's, you know, the love that you feel for your favorite pencil. I mean, if you want to say all those things are the same, I guess you can.
There's reciprocation. That is, if you take the leap and, you know, say, yes, I am going to go ahead and get married or something. I do feel comfortable enough about this. I do have enough faith in my future wife that we're going to go ahead and take the step, then it seems like there's something akin to verification in that if it does in fact turn out well. Whereas if I love a distant celebrity, then that love might keep me warm on cold nights. But
well, you're assuming that verification requires reciprocation, though.
Yes.
Right? I mean, the reciprocation for religion is sort of internal to the
right.
belief itself.
Yeah. Like Dante being in love with Beatrice. The 12-year-old he only saw on the bridge.
Yeah, exactly. Being religious is like being in love with a 12-year-old.
Who you never met, right?
Yeah.
No,
Send your hate mail to...
That's all right. My email's the only one on the site. I'll take it.
So help me understand kind of the discussion where it stands now. And connect it to this idea that this pragmatic method or pragmatic view of things, it's not just about belief, it's also about being a guide or a rule for action. That there has to be some practical consequence to believing something for it to be true, and that that's actually the measure of truth, is the utility of the practical consequence. And if,
or is that the measure of the meaning of it being meaningful at all?
I don't know. I don't really know what language to use here. I mean, last time when we talked, the word utility kept coming to mind, and not utility in the utilitarian sense, but like usefulness, practicality. And, you know, it says if believing something makes no practical difference, then it's not just that it has no meaning. It's not just that it's useless. It's that it's not true. So
it doesn't have truth value.
It doesn't have truth value because it's no practical guide to action. It's useless. That's the only way I can think of to say it. So your long distance love of Reese Witherspoon has no practical utility to her, but it has some practical utility to you. So to some extent, it's true insofar as it has usefulness. It has practical consequences for you. I wanted to bring back what you guys were talking about in terms of belief and tying it back to this idea of a practical consequence.
Right.
And so there are places in the pragmatism lectures where he says, if something has no practical consequence, it's not just useless or meaningless. It's not true. So my reading of that says that trivial facts, like this small portion of the wall in my office is white, which really has no practical consequence for me, and certainly not for anybody else. It's not just a useless, trivial fact. It's not true.
I don't think that's right, though.
You think that's a wrong reading, or you think that's not right to say that?
Yeah, I think he would say that's true.
Okay.
I think the practical consequence thing is a more broad criterion. It's practical in the sense of, you know, it's part of a web of beliefs, which has implications. And
yeah, but there's all sorts of things that you can feed into it having a practical consequence.
Okay.
In terms of your environment, I mean, just from the standpoint, let's just pick just straight up physical theory. You know, the way you would describe the world with a physical, mathematical, chemical theory, the consistency involved and stuff like that, that the fact that the wall is white would fall at least into that. You know, the question of the wavelengths of the light being that color also has consequences in terms of the theory, just because of consistency, that all the other colors have the relationships that they have to themselves, to each other, which has practical consequences for you all the time. So it just in terms of what you see every day. So the fact that that wall is white is tied with everything that you see all the time.
The practical consequence here is actually just the perception itself.
Sure.
What he talks about is verification. And I don't think there's another thing by James that is radical empiricism.
Yeah, I've read some of those.
Yeah, he believes in this direct perception. You know, and then some of what we read in the meaning of truth. The idea is that truth leads you up to, there's this functional relationship where you might start out with an idea, say that the house is up the hill, and there's a lot of potentiality there, right? That piece of knowledge is not that robust. It's almost like a variable. It's not that robust until it's acted upon. So you display your knowledge of that or the truth of that in your walking up the hill and your ability to function based on that belief. And that functioning is just the practical consequence. But part of it is there's a termination to all of that. And one of the terminations is getting up to the house and directly experiencing it. That's sort of the consequence of a whole chain of what he calls these conjunctive relationships, almost like associations. You find yourself walking up the hill, and then there's a termination. There are a number of different possible terminations, but one of the terminations is simply the direct perception of the thing in front of you, which counts as this pragmatic consequence.
Well, and is it also the case that what's going to count as the correct termination that would verify, would make you call a belief true, is the purpose that you have in holding the belief? We never just take up a belief and ask ourselves, you know, is this true or not? We always have some purpose for wanting to know why. Maybe it's just curiosity.
Yeah.
And that's going to determine. So that example that you were given from pragmatism, Seth, last time, that, you know, the guy's going up the trail and is thirsty and thinks that there's a house ahead where he might be able to get a drink. Well, if he actually gets a drink, then it worked out. And you could ask, well, what if he just, and this is not from pragmatism, what if he's just collapsed? He hallucinated, thought he saw a house, but somebody found him there collapsed, gave him a drink, and then went on his way. So he wakes up and thinks he went to the house. So there's a challenge there. Would we say it was true that his original belief that if I follow this trail, then I'm going to find the house and get a drink of water, when he thinks that's what happens and his desire in wanting to know that was verified?
Well, it wasn't. It wasn't a direct perception. And it becomes complicated because he has a number of different formulations, right? He also talks about it as what we would be fated to believe if inquiry. It's a very Peircean type of formulation, but it's at the end of the pragmatism lectures. But what we would be fated to believe if inquiry were extended indefinitely. So in the case of empirical truth, it's not that truths change exactly. You know, he gets into the whole half-truth thing and the absolute truth. So it gets kind of complicated. But the absolute, the realities themselves don't change, even though our relationships do. And you might call it, say it's true on some provisional verification, but then it's overturned. But he ends up calling those things half-truths. So say Maxwell's equations were sort of partial truths or half-truths, and then, you know, Einstein's modification of that is probably still another partial truth, but ultimately you could get to some absolute truth as a sort of faded product of indefinite inquiry.
But it's not necessarily going to be the case that in the wake of, for instance, Einstein's theory, that you're going to even understand Maxwell's theory in the same way that you did before. And so it doesn't seem completely clear that even though you have these kinds of revisions of how you understand the world, in which you have a place for all the facts that you had beforehand, so that you have to still account for the same sort of data set, that you necessarily understand the origin of that data set in the same way. The picture of the world is different, so that when, you know, you have action at a distance in Newton and you have, you know, Newton's account of it, well, then when you come up with Maxwell and you think of it as a field, and you even have the same mathematics that you did with Newton, but now you really understand it as being a field theory, then that's going to give you a different picture of the world, that it's no longer the case that the moon is acting and the Earth are acting at a distance, unmediated in between. It really is that they both are the sources of fields that are permeating the universe everywhere, and that at their particular distances, those fields create a potential that results in a force. The end result is the same facts are there. The Earth and the moon are orbiting in the way that they do, and that they move the tides in the same way, and you get the same equations of motion, but the picture of the world you have is different. So
Maxwell's equations, so you have to modify the equation divided by the square root of 1 minus the speed of light squared, right?
So, well, yeah, so then with the case of relativity, you're going to modify the equations themselves. So that's another case, but it seems to me that both of them, that just because you modify and you have a kind of revision of scientific theory, which is certainly true and part and parcel to it, sometimes you throw away things altogether. Like you throw away caloric because that fails somehow as a concept. Other cases, you revise them, and so you somehow keep the name, but it's not clear that it stays exactly the same, that whatever you meant by correspondence is exactly the same. It seems to likely that you revise those things as well. That it's not kind of a simple accretion. Like it's not like a spiral where you're spiraling in towards the truth at every instance.
I thought he was saying we are gradually...
Well, that's why I qualified
getting
this.
Better, getting more, you know, as inquiry goes on. And I think he does say Maxwell's equations, right, strictly speaking, are yeah. false. And then we might say, yes. Well, yeah, they don't work for frames that have a relative speed approaching the speed of light or something
sure.
like that.
Now, James does talk about truth as a limit in much of the way Peirce does in some places. But I think yeah. he's really clear that even though that's part of the concept, and in fact, that concept itself has utility, right? If we think, if I apply the correct scientific method long enough, this will get me closer to truth or something. So that in itself has utility. However, he wants us to make really clear that that concept is an abstraction from actual verification experiences. And there's a conflict there that I'm not sure that I can make sense of, because on the one hand, he says he's a fallibilist, which if you're a fallibilist, that means you're always saying, I could be wrong, even though right now I think I'm right. I could be wrong, so the truth is always going to be transcendent. It's going to be transcendent of any right. given experience. But on the other hand, he wants to make really clear that this concept of truth as a limit is just a pale abstraction from the concretes, and we can't then... He doesn't want to call them, you know, half-truths, and really the truth is this unobtainable thing that we could only theoretically get at if we were allowed to pursue inquiry forever and ever. Like he really wants to retain the word truth. He does use the word true insofar forth some of the time. I guess I would.
Yeah,
I like that better than half truth, because that points to like the full. Oh, we can't get at the full. Yeah. We can never get at the full.
Yeah, like, I think these are different. And this is part of the problem. He's using the word truth in different ways in those circumstances, right? It's important that James isn't simply just taking a word and giving it a new definition, right? This can't simply be a semantic reassignment. So when you talk about the nature of something, there has to be some fundamental intuition about truth that's preserved, and then we go on to modify the theory. Otherwise, it just becomes, I can use truth to mean whatever I want, right? So he has to be preserving some intuition about truth, even as he rejects correspondence, and even as he says, well, agreement means this functional relationship. And I think that basic intuition is just to say, if we say, and this is formulated formally by a logician later on, but this is sort of the commonly accepted basic intuition with the least metaphysical commitments, which is that if you say, for instance, quote unquote, it's raining outside is true, that's true if and only if it's raining outside. So that's the basic intuition that you start from, and then you say, well, what does that mean? Does it mean correspondence? Does it mean coherence? Does it mean this? Does it mean that? But you can't simply discard the initial basic intuition. Otherwise, you're just redefining a word.
Right, but it's the basic intuition there, James would say, it's important that that's a particular. That, yes, it gets at a class of similar things, but because it's a particular, you can't immediately abstract just from that something like, you know, any statement I make about an alleged fact, there is some state of affairs out in the world, whether I could possibly have any experience of it or not. You know, so there's limits of the applicability of these particular examples. So you're right. He does want to do justice to, I think, all of the particular examples, but he doesn't want to let us abstract from any one of them and come up with this transcendental theory then that would rule out some of the other ways he wants to use the term. That example of it's raining only is a paradigm case, because it's easy to verify, right?
Okay.
And then you can start considering sort of more borderline cases. And he, in one of the Meaning of Truth chapters...
By the way, it's not as obvious as it may seem, because it's not just a matter of direct experience. There's a whole web of background beliefs required in order to make that statement, right? So, for instance, the water coming down could be from something else. Part of the meaning of raining has to do with precipitation and blah, blah, blah. There's a whole theoretical commitment. So there's also consistency with a whole web of beliefs that's involved in that. But yeah, you're right. It's easy to verify. What am I saying?
Right.
I don't know. I just think it's interesting. We seem to be using the term belief kind of loosely here. And I realized at some point during the conversation in the last 20 minutes or so that I've been thinking about this very much from a subjectivist and kind of epistemological point of view. And that, you know, you guys, when you talk about this web of belief, you're really mentioning metaphysics because it's not a web of belief. Like for me, I don't have a web of belief about the physical laws of the universe. They're out there and somebody's written them down and there's been research and somehow it makes my television work and that kind of thing. But I don't have a consistent or coherent or really any sense of beliefs about the physical laws of the universe.
I disagree with you about that, Seth. I think you certainly do. You just might not have it in the same way, you know, as a mathematical theory, right? But you walk around every day. For instance, you pick up a pen and you set it down, and whether you've articulated it or not, you have expectations regarding how that's going to behave.
Yes, but I can give a Humean account of my experience of that explains that by habit, not by any sense of... Well, so I was getting the point saying that you've touched on something that's clearly the case. I'm saying that I don't have whether it's articulated or not, and whether I say, well, it's really just habit. Like I have a psychological habit because I've seen it happen 1,000 times. I expect it to happen again. And that's got nothing to do with some web of belief. It's just my subjective experience of the world. But I think you guys are right. Like there is something to the fact that it's part of a consistent system, and that James wants to say that you should believe things that fit with other things that make sense to believe, that you're right to talk about a web of belief. It just sounds funny to me. The word belief doesn't seem to fit in that sense, in the same way that, like, say, for example, my belief in God would. That's a whole different kind of belief, at least in this context.
I think you're right. He's the pluralist when it comes to religion. But, you know, again, I think we should remember he takes great pains not... He's furious at being called a relativist, right? You know, that chapter in The Meaning of Truth on the misinterpreters. He wants to say that, yes, there are realities, and we brush up against those realities in a certain way. We can't just decide what we want to be true.
Right, and that's what objectivity is for him. It's that we cannot arbitrarily focus our belief. It has to work its way around these pre-existent things.
Yeah, but in the case of religion, I think there's a lot more leeway because it's not an empirical matter, and it's the criteria and the things that we're bumping up against are more variable from individual to individual, and they're essentially internal. So you could say true for me in that case, in a sense, coherently, right? Because to say, you know, I think he would say, in you talking about God, you're not really making a metaphysical assertion about an entity. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But, you know, he talks more about promise, right? And the emotional significance of what it means to be religious and establishing hope or promise. I forget the word he uses exactly.
Forgive me for doing a thought experiment here, but let's take, for example, the belief that if I say, I don't believe in gravity, or if I believe that I pick up this pen and instead of it dropping to the ground, it will float up to the ceiling. So there are any number of things that should work against me believing that that would actually happen. Beginning with, obviously, my own first-person experience of everything falling to the ground when you drop it up until this point. Then factor in that, you know, there's been experiments and theory and proof and learning and teaching and, you know, there's mathematical formulas and other people's experience, that I've never heard a story of anybody I know has never said, oh yeah, I picked up this pen and I let it go and it floated up to the ceiling instead of dropping to the floor. You have all these things that basically say, it sort of speaks to the truth of gravity. And you have a lot of things to back that up and to make it fit. But when you talk about something about, like, for example, belief in God, then that nexus of things that would make that true or validate that belief become a lot more difficult to put together. You don't have the consistent set of experience like you do with the physical world, perhaps. There are people that claim to believe in God, and then there are those who don't, and then there are those who claim to believe in other gods, right? And so you get further and further away from being able to capture this huge set of experiences or other sorts of things that are going to somehow justify this belief. And so that's the part that I'm trying to, I feel like I'm in the same place I was last time we talked about this, where like I feel like it comes down to some sort of subjective thing, which isn't relativism necessarily. It's, you know, being subjective is not necessarily being relative, but at the same time, there seems to be this non-subjective element to it that can lend a lot of weight. That it's the non-subjective other mind and external world kind of things that make it so that you should believe one thing and not another, that have a tendency to give more weight to those sorts of things. They're just easier to believe. It's easier to believe in gravity than it is to believe in God, because not just of the practical experiences, but because of that whole consistent set of experiences and beliefs and so forth.
It sounds to me like a bit that part of what James is trying to preserve is the genuineness of the meaning of those other sorts of experiences. That religious experience or subjective experience is genuine, valid experience by which one can and does make decisions about one's life, that they have practical consequences. I guess the question would be how he judges that disposition towards religious meaning as opposed to other kinds of decisions that we make.
Right. So I think what I'm trying to say is that it just becomes more difficult the further you get away from the so-called objective experience or other people's experience. But that doesn't mean it's invalid, and it doesn't mean it's impossible. It just becomes more difficult. And so where some people would say, look, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it, right? If you can't validate it, it's not true. If it's not something that you can map against a correspondence theory of truth, then it has no meaning. And James is saying, well, that's just completely not true. It's ridiculous to say that somebody's religious beliefs have no meaning. And somebody says, well, they have no truth, so they have no meaning. And he's like, well, all right, if that's the route we're going to go, then I'm going to find a way to say that they have some kind of truth. So suddenly, if you're able to rationalize, so to speak, your belief in God or some sort of religious belief and make it fit with your overall set of beliefs about the objective world and about what other people believe about God or don't believe about God and your subjective experience, then in a sense, you're kind of validating it by proxy and you're giving it truth, giving it meaning. I feel like it's almost like sleight of hand. And yet at the same time, I'm kind of sympathetic to the idea that this is so hard.
Well, but isn't part of the problem for this distinction is where the role of judgment comes in regarding what we want to accede to be true or valuable or good? That it's going to get tied up with that, especially when you speak of things like religion. So it's one thing to say, well, I believe in God and have it be very, very amorphous. But then you get into very specific things that God told me to do or told me how to act and the sort of consequences involving that. And very quickly, you can easily get into conflicts, whether it be with sort of, you know, physical realists or just with other religions regarding what the consequences of actual actions ought to be. And that part of the problem here is going to be involve those kinds of judgments about everyday living that we have. Should you be forcing women to wear burqas or whatever the latest thing that you want to pick that one religion considers to be objectionable to another?
There's this forced option that he talks about, and this makes the pace different from between the sciences and religion. So I'm looking at page 7 now, The Will to Believe. He says, wherever the option between losing truth and gaining it is not momentous, we can throw the chance of gaining truth away, and at any rate save ourselves from any chance of believing falsehood by not making up our minds at all until objective evidence has come. In scientific questions, this is almost always the case. And even in human affairs in general, the need of acting is seldom so urgent that a false belief to act on is better than no belief at all. But in our dealings with the objective nature, we are obviously recorders, not makers of truth. see, this sounds in tension with what I'll later say in the pragmatism lecture, but it's reconcilable. So we're recorders, not makers of truth, when we're talking about empirical, objective nature. And decisions for the mere sake of deciding promptly and getting on to the next business would be wholly out of place. Throughout the breadth of physical nature, facts are what they are independently of us, and seldom is there any such hurry and blah, blah, blah. So I think the critical thing about religion is that it's an important decision and has huge consequences for a life. The criterion for it must be our quote-unquote passional nature, where we can't look to the external world as a criterion of whether or not to believe. And then finally, it's a forced option. We really can't just say we're going to suspend judgment because suspending judgment has such huge consequences. Well, that's not the same thing as an objective science, where we do kind of take a more measured stance and let the evidence roll in. Religion is an urgent decision.
But I like that at the beginning of this, he gives you an out, which is that this is only a matter of choosing between what are live options for you.
Yeah.
And he doesn't give any criteria for this. It's just, if you find something too unpalatable to believe, then you're not going to believe it, and you can't make yourself believe it, and so it's not among the choices that
See, Mark, I feel like you were on the... He almost converted you to Christianity, and then you went back up and found the live option loophole, escape clause.
Well, it does, and he says at the end, hey, if you don't buy this, it's probably because you're thinking you have some particular creed in mind that is a dead option to you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'll accept that. So just casting back, many podcasts ago, I put forward in passing a who gives a damn theory about religious beliefs, which is that I don't care. It does not seem a forced option to me. And putting this in Jamesian terms then, I'll say, because all the interpretations of religion where it matters are dead options to me. So that there are, you know, all your traditional religions say, if you don't believe in God, God will be mad at you. Well, that seems ridiculous to me. God is so powerful. He has better things to think about than whether I believe or not. So, in other words, it's not, I'm not going to get in trouble for not believing, or like, as long as you act well, then you'll go to heaven if there is a heaven, even if you don't believe. Like, that seems more palatable to me than only the believers will go to heaven. Well, what about all the people that, you know, were born in countries where this religion didn't exist? Well, they'll all go to hell. Like, that's not a live option to me.
You know, it's interesting. I think his definition of religion, though, becomes very broad, so that even your inclination towards naturalism, or, you know, he says, quote unquote, our belief in truth itself, for instance, that there is a truth, and that our minds and it are made for each other, what is it but a passionate affirmation of desire,
yes,
in which our social system backs us up? So there's always some belief that we're starting from, even if it's a belief in reason, and it's something like a religious belief. Ultimately, it has to be, right? Because we're not going to, ultimately, our evidence stops somewhere, and we just have to say, yeah, I accept the naturalistic framework, and I can't really give any reasons for that. But once I've accepted that conceptual scheme, then, of course, everything else will, my acceptance of scientific evidence and so on and so forth makes sense.
And Dylan was saying at the beginning, right, that it's not, this is not just a matter of the big generalities like that. This is a matter of the particulars, right, that most of our beliefs are not verified, in fact.
Yeah.
He said something like 99% of the beliefs that we have, we just, they haven't caused us trouble. So
yeah,
we accept them. We go along with them. We're only, going back to Peirce's fixation of belief, we only seek to verify or adjust our belief when some sort of conflict is raised.
Yeah.
So using the looser definition that James seems to want to give sometimes for truth, all of my beliefs are true except the ones that are being actively challenged right now.
Well,
right?
I mean, Seth said earlier that, well, this is, you know, essentially can be accounted for by a kind of Humean thing of a habit of experience. And it's not clear to me that James would disagree that belief has something strongly in common with the idea of habit of experience, except that the habit of experience is more robust than Hume would take it to be, that it's not as ad hoc, that there are things connecting event to event the habit of experience that structuralize it, even if it's not made 100% wholly consistent across all of experience in that structure, that there's lots of structure in our habit of experience that leads us to decide some things are surprising and some things aren't surprising, to have expectations about virtually every moment, certainly extrapolating out in short amounts of time and close amounts of distances. We have all kinds of things that we have as part of our expectations. And some things are surprising in the sense of they're surprising that we didn't expect them, but they are on the plate for possible actions. You know, a thunderstorm comes up and it was a blue sky and it was surprising that there was a thunderstorm. And there's a whole other set of things that are surprising that are not even on the landscape of possibility. You know, aliens landed, or the tree disappeared, or the burning bush. I mean, all kinds of things like that that are unexpected in a different way than other things are unexpected. But the fact that they're unexpected at all, that you can be surprised at all, has to do with the fact that you have a structure to your habit of experience that isn't merely ad hoc. So it seems like, yes, you know, you would say, well, yeah, our belief is a kind of habit of experience, but it's more than something ad hoc.
Even to make that Humean distinction, right, you have to accept metaphysical realism as coherent, right? You have to think that there's some coherent distinction between a belief about causality and some metaphysical truth, or some, I think it gets complicated again because he wants to speak of realities, but yeah, I think the mere custom is enough for him. And then about, you know, about being surprised, I think, you know, he remains a fallibilist about everything. If the tree disappeared, or if the Earth, all things being equal, suddenly stopped revolving around the sun, that would be a new datum in which we'd have to try and integrate into our existing sets of beliefs and our theories. And it's possible, but it seems unlikely based on our current experience. But we always remain a fallibilist about it. Even those very, very secure-seeming truths, we admit that we could be wrong, that they're going to continue to hold forever.
Now, is he a fallibilist about religious faith? Or is it such that religious convictions, sort of by definition, cannot be falsified through future evidence, so we can just hold on to them without ceasing we grab onto them?
I would
them?
Say the latter, yeah.
I don't know about that. I mean, there's plenty of people out there that are grappling with, you know, the problem of evil, who are struggling with the idea that their religious beliefs are being falsified as we speak.
It depends how specific your religious beliefs are.
True.
Like, do they imply specific moral commandments? Like, it's like Dylan was saying about the wearing burqas or something. And this is something that we talked about on the blog a little, and Sam Harris saying you can use, he's a prominent new atheist philosopher, saying you could use science to ground morality, which Wes was attacking as being silly. But insofar... Yes. So while you can't strictly falsify any normative claim through a descriptive claim, there are certainly things that could make you question them. There's new evidence. So if you were, you know, a super racist, and then you get to know some of the oppressed group, and you sort of think, the reasons I was super racist don't really seem to apply, right? These people are really not soulless. They're not animals or something. Then you would adjust your expectations. If you believe that all women should wear burqas because there's just going to be social chaos if they don't, that they're just going to immediately fall into sin, but then you actually, you know, talk to women and get to understand their psychology more, and that they are not crazed nympho animals.
The typical objection to that, those are hypotheticals based on more fundamental normative claims, so that soulless people aren't deserving of our respect.
Sure.
It's a hypothetical to extend it. The fundamental normative claim couldn't be altered by
right, but that just says that most of the moral rules as we actually apply them involve a mixture of these potentially fundamental normative claims and a lot of beliefs about particular circumstances. And
yeah, I agree with
that. Attacking the particular circumstances can have a very profound effect on your overall moral philosophy.
Yeah, I think that's true, but you can't derive a normative claim simply from experience, is what I'm saying.
Sure, but as a practical matter, since we're talking, people using applied ethics don't walk around, you know, philosophers are the exception, you know, trying to apply the categorical imperative or the utility maxim or something, you know, purely normative thing. You know, for the most part, there are these, you know, rules of thumb or rules that are, you know, very specific rules, which then either they're not clear of what the basis are. I mean, maybe you, if you're religious, you might say, fundamentally, God wants what's right for us. And now I read the Bible and it says, you know, if somebody commits adultery, you should stone them, or is gay, you should stone them. But then I sort of learned more about these things, and I realized that's a savage behavior in a society, and you sort of get your outlook a little more civilized. Well, then it is your fundamental normative claim, God wants what's best for us, that would drive you to change your moral precepts. So for a practical matter,
you change your application based on those.
Right. And if you're a pragmatist, the application is what matters. So I guess by analogy, you might have general non-verifiable, non-falsifiable beliefs in a God that rules over us, but how you think this applies in particular circumstances, in other words, like, does God watch over us and listen to our prayers? You know, you might think, yes, he does, but then you pray and pray and pray and your child dies of cancer anyway. Okay, I guess God doesn't watch over us and listen to our prayers. That kind of experience happens to people. That seems to be
somewhere
where James would have to say, even though you had faith, I don't know, what would James say about that? That it's better to keep having the faith, or you just modify the faith? You say, you back off, you have faith in an overall grand scheme that things are getting better, but it is not in your interest, it is not useful to sort of kick yourself in the face and say, oh, I must have deserved that, or my child that died must have deserved that, or something like that. You just chalk it up to, not everything is good.
Well, actually, Mark, I think that's an interesting example, because to some extent, what it does is make the point that there may not be such a thing as a non-verifiable, non-falsifiable belief, that ultimately your beliefs are going to have to cash out in some way. So in this case, let's say your belief in this God cashes out in such a he or she is good and that everything happens in the world for a reason. So if in the case you're talking about, you know, you have faith, you believe everything happens for a reason and your child dies of cancer, then you better come up with a reason, or you better believe that there is a reason, even if you can't fathom it, for why that happened. And so, you know, that's the way you make that consistent. That's the way you make that belief true. Now, the interesting thing here is that that's going to turn out to end up making that belief false for somebody else, who then is going to give up on the idea of God, or
it will become a dead option to them.
It'll become a dead,
at least that kind of God. Yeah.
Yes. And what's interesting to me here is that then it becomes a question of having those two people who have that experience
fight.
That's right. Why God did it to both of them, is to see who wins this fight.
Well,
war.
He has a bet with the devil. Well, that's Job, isn't it?
No, but it, you know, in kind of my perverse hermeneutic, you know, Jewish kind of tendencies, like that's what I think makes the thing really interesting to me, is that what you end up with is people having to justify, or at least interpret, the belief in the context of everything that's happened, in the context of all these other beliefs, to make sense of it and for it to have truth for them. And kind of, I feel like those two apparently contradictory things might both end up being true. And then we fall into the relativism trap. Or do we? Because the cash value of believing or not believing that there's a good God really doesn't have a practical consequence in the same way that believing and not believing in gravity does. Can two people hold opposite positions and we say that, well, subjectively, it's true for one and true for the other, but that's not really relativism in the metaphysical sense of metaphysical. It's true and not true.
I think true is being used in sort of an attenuated way there, sort of a pluralistic true for me, where it means something different than... I mean, I think it's a good question, though, is there... Because religious claims, I mean, typically we would think that they're making claims about, say, existence, right? Like the existence of God, or, and that would be, you know, a question of fact. But James almost seems to be saying that that's really not relevant, maybe, or in the sense that because it's not a verifiable, empirically verifiable, or empirically not verifiable, that what we're left to, the only criterion that we're left to, is live options and what suits us or makes our life better. And that could be different for people. I don't know, you know, but then you might, you know, to take a more Kantian line, there it is, I mentioned him, you could say, well, there's something so consistent about human nature that the forced option is actually limited to one, that there's a sort of implication towards one religious or general religious framework. I don't know. You know, and even atheism, right? I mean, it's not like he's arguing that atheism is bunk. All he wants to be saying is that you're no worse off being religious than being atheist. It's not like you're any more crackpot or any more irrational.
And isn't part of that argument for James center on making the point about our disposition towards the things we usually think about as facts? Turning it back around to saying that, well, the question of belief seems to loom large with religion, and so we criticize it as not being rational. And that part of his way of saving religion is this pragmatic understanding of rationality, that there are beliefs founding our rationality.
Yeah.
Isn't that the tack he takes?
Yeah, even rationality requires a fundamental commitment to rationality, right? It's not just simply that it's self-evident. There's no Cartesian foundationalist clear and distinct idea that's going to give you, that's going to say you're bound to rationality. We have to start somewhere sort of by fiat, by saying, yes, I have faith in reason, I have faith in naturalistic accounts, and I'm going to proceed on those assumptions.
Yeah, or even I have faith in clear and distinct, but that clear and distinct doesn't make it any more surely true than saying that I believe it.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think whether this whole faith in reason thing is really what James is saying or makes sense. I mean, he thinks that there are...
You're trying to decide one or the other? Whether this is what he's saying or whether it makes sense.
And or whether... There are restrictions placed on our beliefs just in our experience, right? Just like he says, some of these beliefs are live and some of these are dead, and that's not really a matter of choice. The choice comes after those things get ruled out. And I don't think it's a live option for us to disbelieve the law of non-contradiction. In fact, he says the things that restrict our belief are, first of all, our perceptions. You know, we just find ourselves encountered with things around us and we believe that they are there, unless somebody gives us a really good reason not to. Plus, what I interpret to be a priori intuitions, in other words, logical truths, mathematical truths, we just see, and it sounds very much like the way Kant describes it, we have an intuition, we see that, you know, the Pythagorean theorem is true. You don't say, I have faith in general that these mathematical intuition experiences are correct. We just think they're correct. We can't help but think they're correct. So it's not that everything is faith-based. It's just that beyond that, it's just a matter of making sure any new belief that's coming in accords with our existing beliefs. But then a lot of those beliefs can be moved around, and that, you know, if the new belief is more important and conflicts.
But I think what he's saying, though, it's not that we are compelled by those specific cases of correctness. But that whole scheme of correctness is an underlying faith. I'm not sure that he thinks you could really give a transcendental or like Aristotle's law of non-contradiction argument, or that you're going to be able to convince, say, a relativist, or because the relativist already rejects your whole commitment to rational argument, right? So you're not going to dissuade them. I don't know. You might be right as a matter of empirical fact, though, that we're simply bound to believe. I'm not sure. A little confusing.
Yeah, that's the way I interpret the will to believe. If a belief terminates in one of these satisfactory conditions, the most blatant of which were those two I just gave, verification by sensory perception or verification by a prior intuition, I don't know how else to say it, but seeing the truth of a truth of reason. But beyond that, again, as a practical matter, even a lot of these things that could be verified in one of these ways, we don't. So those are just taken on faith, more or less. And then these larger generalizations or things that are just beyond the realms, you know, things that cannot be reducible to verification experiences or a priori truths, those are more fair game. We have to have faith in them one way or another, which includes anything about the future, anything about methodological commitments. So I think you're right that there is, you know, a faith in the scientific method involved, if you want to call it that. I would have much less objections to people calling it that if he was as non-dogmatic about these so-called types of faith. Because to me, like, he could just as well use the word hypothesis, right? I think that the scientific method of accepting, let's be specific about this, the thing about science that you were objecting to in the mind episode, you know, I think that we should only base truths of science, for instance, on visually verifiable third-person perspective verifiable phenomena. Well, you could then encounter some evidence, like reading Nagel's paper, What Is It Like to Be a Bat, and say, oh, I need to modify my view of scientific hypothesis itself. It was just a hypothesis. I didn't have faith in this specific type of explanation. And that's just different than religious faith, which, as you were saying, you could just grab onto and nothing will make you shake it.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a difference between religion, right, and empirical science, and that religion admits of pluralism. But I think when you're talking about specific scientific hypotheses, right, it's not that those are a matter of faith. Those are a matter of consistency, but all all of that comes into place only once you have accepted the whole scheme of naturalistic inquiry and consistency itself. You know, he says our belief in truth itself, for instance, that there is a truth.
Yeah.
And that our minds are made for it is a passionate affirmation of desire and blah, blah, blah. You have to sort of zoom out to the most general level to the sort of systemic commitment to rational inquiry, and that's faith. But once you get inside it, then it's no longer a matter of faith about belief in gravity. You're sort of compelled to it based on evidence and all those things. But the commitment to concepts of evidence and the logical, you know, modus ponens and all of that, that's one big system that rests on a kind of faith. It's not self-evident.
Just listening and thinking about what James says in his contrasting of religion with rationality, which is, of course, very, very common, it makes me think that one of the things that he just doesn't talk about enough is the way in which, in terms of generating oughts and having ethical and moral stands, that religion has a lot more to do with politics than it has to do with reason. And that in terms of its the relation that authority has to making the metaphysical claims that religion makes, even if there are things we bump up against in the world and stuff like that, that the real power of religion is not in the things you bump up against in an everyday way. It has more to do with the ways in which the authority of politics works on us and the way we think our power relations between each other are and the authority that people have over us. That people who hear Moses believe in the Ten Commandments because of Moses, because of him, and because of his authority essentially as a politician. I mean, it's a little crass to say it that way, but as the charismatic leader. And then that stand has authority on its own and as is a sink for belief. And then bumping up against that is different than bumping up against the wall or falling in the river or getting frostbite. Those kinds of things are different than bumping up against the authority of your parents or bumping up against the authority of somebody bigger than you who insists that what they're doing is right because they have the strength to enforce that right.
Yeah, I was thinking something similar in that those points from Peirce's article, The Fixation of Belief, that obviously James was familiar with. He like took it as the foundation for quite a lot of what he was writing, but he doesn't really talk about those social pressures, right? You can't really have a happy pluralism if your neighbor believes something, or your spouse, better yet, believes something violently different from you. That seems to make your religious belief not work in a significant way if it causes strife in your home.
Well, and this is why the scientific model of pluralism doesn't necessarily work, right? Because I think Wes was saying this, that there's a whole bunch of stuff you buy into if you basically believe in scientific inquiry, even if you disagree with one theory or another. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of stuff you buy into about sincerity of judgment regarding effects, the kind of ways in which you expect evidence to have a characteristic of being able to be seen by everybody else. But political authority and religious authority don't require those kinds of things. That, in fact, there may even be a premium on individuals who have sight that no one else has, and that you cede their authority because of them. And the fact that Moses speaks to God, but no one else does, that's not a big deal because, well, we have, you know, ceded our authority to Moses. But the notion that everybody can have somehow glimpse the evidence, you know, which is sort of a bedrock of, you know, scientific thinking, maybe if not rational thinking, that's going to be completely against it. So just like what Mark said, that, you know, if you have a different foundation of where the authority comes from for making these judgments, you're not going to necessarily be able to have a common ground for deciding on what the outcomes ought to be. You can still have lots of arguments, even if you already agree on the source of authority. But if you don't even agree on the source of authority, then you're going to have all kinds of problems.
Well put.
We haven't brought in the point yet. This is from his lecture 5 in Pragmatism. Pragmatism and Common Sense, where he says, the part that's in capital letters, a page or two in, our fundamental ways of thinking about things are discoveries of exceedingly remote ancestors, which have been able to preserve themselves throughout the experience of all subsequent time. So a lot of the things that we, you know, I was saying that we have to take into account a priori intuitions, these themselves were achievements. They're not self-evident. They are self-evident to us now because of the culture that we are in. He even says, like, as babies, we just have this pure stream of experience. And we don't pick out individual objects. But once we hit on this strategy of picking out individual objects and thinking about this object existing over time, we cannot escape that strategy anymore, even though it's a human contribution. So this is kind of like Kant's idea of the categories, but he's really saying that all those things were at some point discoveries that, you know, animals or different kinds of animals might not have these things.
Yeah, this is awesome. You see the list of categories that he has after that? It's like Darwin's version of Aristotle's categories.
Yeah, thing, the same or different, kinds, minds, bodies, one time, one space, subjects and attributes, causal influences, the fancied and the real.
Yeah, those are awesome. Those make so much more sense than Aristotle's categories. I can hardly stand it.
I think that it just says the most important of our concepts are these. This is not supposed to be an exhaustive list. This is just
No, but the way in which, you know, he's appealing to a Darwinian evolution of mind, that these distinctions of conceptual categories are mm-hmm. the result of an evolutionary track
yeah.
of human beings altogether. And that, just like you said, Mark, we don't even realize that we are making those kinds of distinctions as children. We aren't taught, you know, well, look at the world in these sets of categories, these common sense conceptual categories. They might be refined through learning, but in some ways we already do those things, and that's a consequence of our evolution as human beings.
Now, when you bring in that analogy, then I start thinking about the things that didn't make the cut. Corgo the caveman think everything is banana. Corgo soon die. Banana thought is not carried on in species. Or Thales calling. Thales says everything is water. And yet, that didn't work out. That is not part of our conceptual apparatus to see everything is water now.
Well, unless you're doing acid. I mean, sometimes it's... Depends on your state of mind, dude.
Everything is the one. She says it's a useful concept sometimes to have. That everything is one.
Yeah, you read that whole section on that, yeah.
So I guess I was kind of wondering about the relation between these, the cultural fix that these things have on us, because even if we admit that these are cultural, we can't escape them. This is just how we see stuff. And this faith that you're talking about, like, it seems we don't need faith for these things because they encounter us as things beyond our control. So faith involves some kind of choice.
Well, Mark, explain more about the distinction that you want to make between those two things, that the things that are part of our structure that we just do, even if you want to say they're inescapable, but they are not founded, and the notion of, you know, belief or faith or ascension to the way it is, whatever you want to call those background things that are granted without justification. Say more about what you mean by the difference between those two things.
I think that James might be wanting to give the sort of argument that, well, Wes has brought up a couple times, that it seems like the notion of God itself, Kant says something like this, but the notion of God itself is maybe like one of these things. That, well, if you're honest with yourself, you can't help but believe that we are just isolated souls wandering around with pure separateness. You know, that we ultimately have this notion that there is a fundamental oneness and there is a power in the world greater than we are. You know, so that's a predisposition in us. And you could say it's cultural or maybe it's biological. The fact is, we don't know. I think James is going to say that all these things are cultural, but even so, he thinks that all the people in the room that he's talking to and giving the lecture the will to believe, you'll probably have the religious hypothesis as a live option at the very least. And it is beyond their control to merely dismiss it.
So that's really interesting. Now, on this list of thing, the same and the different kinds, the fancied, the real, we would have the notion of God.
Maybe. He didn't put that. That's certainly not something that we stumble across in our moment-to-moment empirical existence, which seems to be the kind of things that he's trying to pick out in this list.
Well, I mean, minds doesn't fit into that, right?
I assume that you have a mind. I assume that I have a mind. I reflect on my own mind. We talk about each other's beliefs and desires. That's what I take that to mean.
Yeah, well, it's this kind of thing that I wish I was at the lecture. I'd raise my hand and ask him that question.
who wants to do an old-timey East Coast accent. Pretend to be James. Seth, you can do it.
What?
What truth means, I say.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yes.
Oh.
Do you think he took questions after these things? Wes, do you think it was like the question and answer period after a lecture at St. John's?
I think not only did he take questions, but he went out for drinks with people after that.
Even better.
He accepted their
party.
There's an after party.
Yeah. He accepted their letters. Like he says in one of the pragmatism lectures, like, I have a letter from someone in the audience that is a friend of mine that objected to this point. Like, really? He sent you a letter? And now you're objecting to it? And now he's still sitting in the audience, and yet you're talking about his letter. Just tell him to voice his complaint. Come on.
Well, who was trying to...
I think James must have been a lot of fun, though. A guy who can riff like that, you know, speak and write like that about philosophy. I mean... My God.
And pull off that beard.
Everybody had those beards.
Dude.
Not the way James did, though.
That was a pretty serious...
I like the beard better than the mutton chops. It's good that he went with that.
I'm looking at the picture now. He looks pretty severe in the picture. He looks kind of angry. Wikipedia picture.
I saw the movie not that long ago, Miss Potter. You know, the one about Beatrix Potter. And everybody has those freaking giant sideburns and... pokey out beards and absurd mustaches. And then in the DVD extras, it had, like, you know, pictures of her actual dad, and that's the way they looked. And it's just so much goofier actually seeing them moving around than it is even looking at the photo.
In my after my freshman year of college, I worked on Mackinac Island in northern Michigan as a historical interpreter at the fort. And that year, they started reinterpreting, you know, sort of changed the way the interpreters worked and made us all one era of the fort, which were the 1880s. And so the uniforms for the American infantrymen in the 1880s were Prussian uniforms. They had pickle bulbs on the top of the helmet, just like the German uniforms. And the other thing was this whole thing with facial hair and gigantic mustaches and stuff. So all of us fort interpreters tried to grow mustaches, big, bushy mustaches, and mine was a dismal failure.
I think if you had succeeded in growing it, it would still be a dismal failure.
Wait.
I have to admit, I once tried to grow a mustache, and now I look at pictures of myself.
What?
And I'm like, what was I thinking?
What do you guys mean, try and grow a mustache?
I grew one, sort of, but it's not, you know, it's not the...
I have to fight back facial hair with, like, it is a constant struggle for me. You guys just came from the wrong part of Europe.
Well, no, I can grow a good beard now.
You're just saying when you were 19, you couldn't work. Yeah.
I didn't get a good beard until I was, like, 21.
Now, that makes sense, because I do think there is some correlation between, like, the amount of work you have to do to keep your eyebrows in check and your ability to grow like mutton chops. And like, you know, when you're, you know, I don't think anybody even worries about like eyebrows until you're like 30. And then you start looking at your like older relatives and you're like, oh, okay, this is where I'm going. And then when it looks like, you know, you might be like one of those old grandpa types, you know, where then you have the possibility to grow the out of control mutton chops and beard, but the eyebrows have to go with it.
Well, I just turned 42, and it's probably been the past maybe not 10 years, maybe 6 or 7 years, 8 years. When I go to the barber, the lady asks me, so do you want me to trim your eyebrows for you?
That's right. That's right.
I remember the first time I got asked that. I'm like,
do you want me to trim your ear hair with that?
No, yeah. they already do that. They don't even ask. They just get out the clippers and they just start dragging them over your ears.
Oh, man.
I like to grow the big mutton chops. In fact, I have them right now.
Do you?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
How long have I been thinking about how to relate this back to pragmatism?
Hey.
At least.
Our fans love these digressions. Our fan loves these digressions. All right, so are we done?
Done for the evening.
We going to end on facial hair?
Well, we can do... Well, one thing that I find is interesting is that regardless of how well or poorly prepared any of us were for this, it hasn't become any clearer. I mean, it's definitely confused. I don't think there's any doubt about that, that whatever we may feel about the position. And again...
Wait. Seth, I don't understand what's more confused.
Sorry. Okay.
About this, then, than foundationalism, for instance.
Okay.
Or traditional metaphysics. I mean, that seems, in fact, way more confusing.
Well, listen, we're not having a confusion off of philosophical systems here. What I'm saying is we left the last discussion with, is there a theory of truth here or isn't there? Is it a cop-out? Isn't it? Is it relativism or isn't it? I don't feel like we're any closer to having clarified any of those questions, because it just seems like the more we kind of drill into it, the more we get kind of lost. And there may be several distinct things going on here. You know, the idea of the practical consequence, and then the idea of belief or it's the consistency and the web of beliefs, those actually may be two completely unrelated things that he kind of throws out there that we're trying to stitch together into some sort of coherent picture, but I'm not sure that they are.
His theory of truth doesn't work in the end. It suffers from some fatal flaws, unfortunately. And I think whatever you think of metaphysical realism, metaphysical realism as a theory of truth doesn't necessarily imply foundationalism, I don't think. But I think it implies that there are things in themselves which are beyond both our conceptual abilities and beyond our cognitive interests, in the sense of the kinds of things which would cause us to rationally accept some truth claim or another. I don't think the first part is a problem. It's denying the second part that's a problem. So I think James has real insights here, but it suffers from flaws in the sense that it gets too far away from that initial intuition, which I don't think is metaphysical. And the initial intuition is that to claim a belief is true means that it has to be grounded in something mind-independent. I think he tries to get around that problem with his realities, but, you know, his concept of reality and brushing up against it. But the problem is that the requirement to brush up against reality causes problems for beliefs that we can't really verify or brush up against, or where we can't brush up against reality. So past beliefs is one of the classic, you know, objections to his theory, that something that he can't account for. You know, if I think that, and this is someone else's example, of course, that I've stolen, but if I think that Lizzie Borden committed the axe murders, and no one really knows, right? Some people thought she did, some people thought she didn't. There's no way for me, it was never verified, and there's never going to be verified whether or not she did it. But there still has to be a fact of the matter about whether she committed those murders. So in this case, it can't simply be the case that truth is going to happen to a belief, as James says, because it's never going to happen in this case that we come to a conclusion about the truth of the belief. And it's never going to be the case that we brush up against the right sorts of things that will give us a true belief. So I think the basic point is that there are things which there has to be a fact of the matter about, which we can't possibly know or have true beliefs about. Now, that's not to say that there's a metaphysical realism involved, in the sense that it's in principle impossible, or it's beyond, you know, again, it's beyond verification in principle, or that couldn't have been verified in the same way that things in themselves couldn't be verified. You know, there's no point in history where we can go back and compare something to a thing in itself. So I think the basic anti-metaphysical stance on one interpretation of a metaphysical theory of truth holds, but I think you have to make some modifications to James's theory of truth, which, by the way, I think is just a version of neo-Kantianism, but anyway, in order to make it work.
Isn't the fact that Lizzie Borden knows whether she did it or not, even though she's dead, mean that it is within the realm of possible experiences? I'm not sure I get that example.
You can't say the nature of truth is, you know,
these verified experiences, yeah.
Is verifiability. There have to be non-verifiable. I mean, and you can't say that it's, in this case, it's the horizon, as James sometimes says. It's what we're fated to.
No, you're right. He can't bring that in here. But he can say it's what somebody would have seen had they been there, right? That's the way he deals with all these far off.
That's not what he's saying. That's the Peircean claim. That's how Pierce, I think that's where Pierce's theory does a better job of avoiding that problem. James rejects the idea that truth depends upon what we would reach under ideal epistemic conditions. He's saying that truth involves actual verification, not hypothetical verification. For Pierce, hypothetical as in the sort of ideal horizon of agreement between inquirers is enough. For James, it's not merely, you know, it could have happened. It's, we actually, you know, again, the truth of beliefs requires believers. It requires believers actually come to brush up against it and form some sort of agreement among one another. It's a collective process. You may, Lizzie Borden may know, but you're never going to be able to form a...
So I just don't know. What's the problem with that? It's not that it's a sentence that has no
because
truth
it never
value.
Becomes coercive, because then it's like saying there is no truth of the matter, because it's not coercive over any living inquirer's thought, right? He wants to say that for a belief to be true, it has to brush up against a reality which becomes coercive in some sense. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense to talk of a belief being true, but that violates our fundamental conception that a belief is true if and only if there's a fact of the matter. In other words, let's just put it simply. It's true that Lizzie Borden committed the axe murders. Whether anyone ever, or it's either true or false, whether anyone ever figures that out. So there is a crucial mind independence that a theory has to preserve, which I don't think this theory does preserve. He tries to. Don't get me wrong. I think he tries to.
I mean, he has a chapter in The Meaning of Truth called The Existence of Julius Caesar that I don't remember much of the content of, but doesn't he say, as long as you have a chain back, so you're saying this is different than the Lizzie Borden thing?
But we don't have that chain in this case.
I thought that he had said, well, it's not just actual knowers, it's potential knowers. And, well, I found it's actually Meaning of Truth, Chapter 15, A Dialogue, which is between a pragmatist and an anti-pragmatist. And he considers a certain state of facts, for example, of antediluvian planetary history. So really just anything that people are not, right now, are not in a position to know. And here's the quote. The pragmatist says, there have been innumerable events in the history of our planet which nobody ever has been or ever will be able to give an account, yet of which it can already be said abstractly that only one sort of possible account can ever be true. The truth about any such event is thus already generically predetermined by the event's nature, and one may accordingly say with a perfectly good conscience that it virtually pre-exists. Common sense is right in its instinctive contention. And the anti-pragmatist says, is this then the horn of the dilemma which you stand for? Do you say that there is a truth, even in cases where it shall never be known? The pragmatist says, indeed I do, provided you let me hold consistently to my own conception of truth. Do not ask me to abandon it for something which I find impossible to comprehend. And then he goes on, really just to say that his version of truth is supposed to account for all the same things that the old version does, but it's... Whereas the person he's arguing against doesn't have an analysis of what it is to be true, he thinks if you push the anti-pragmatism far enough, then it has to come down to something about potential knowers. There's really, as long as you're referring to a knower of some sort, an actual or potential, then you are fulfilling James's humanistic program that it has to be based on truth. Whereas the people he's arguing against would say, oh, even if there hadn't been people ever on the world, you know, there still could be such a thing as truth, which is correspondence. You know, it's just state of affairs. Anyway.
Right. The point is that James isn't consistent on that. I know that that's one of his positions. That's the Percian strain in him. And in other places, he's not going with that potential knower's model. And then the potential knower's model suffers from its own defects, which I tried to point out in the first podcast, right, where I talked about the ideal limit of inquiry and whether that's a less metaphysical conception than the thing in itself and
Isn't it that Peirce's kind of has a double abstraction? It's not just potential knowers, but it's potential knowers if they had forever to work at this problem, this is what they would arrive at. Whereas James is saying...
Right.
If somebody were standing right next to this thing and watching it, or in fact, the person who committed the murder or didn't commit the murder, you know, you don't even have to imagine a potential knower. There's one right there. Then that's enough to mean that it has a truth value. And that's all, you know, if that's the objection.
Right.
All right.
I mean, it's kind of ironic that you're arguing for what's sort of an extension of a Kantian.
No, actually, when I was looking at this.
And I'm arguing against it, but it's, I don't think in the end it works, but get so far into disease.
Right. I just didn't want us to be bulldozed.
I can only give that vague idea that it's going to butt up against problems of mind independence. I don't know how to...
Well, right. And actually, there's another quote that I didn't find, which was, he mentions at some point that the thing in itself, right, the Kantian thing in itself, is itself a part of our experience, essentially. Kant is going to say, like, there are things in experience that means there must be a mind-independent ground independent of us, right? Independent of experience. Whereas... James, you know, is looking at the same evidence, and he says, well, we don't actually have warrant to say that there's a mind-independent thing. All we have warrant to say is that just like when we see the front of an object, this is very like the phenomenologists, just like when we're looking at a physical object and we, you know, perceive that it has aspects that we don't see. It has a back. It has an inside. In the same way, there's a implicit extension of anything objective that we perceive that it has this mind-independent part. But yet it's not actually mind-independent. It's just that's how it appears to us in experience. I'm trying to still get my head around how this is different from Kant.
And how to avoid either relativism or idealism, right?
It would lead to maybe, you know, some form of relativism, but it's a species-wide relativism in much the same way Kant is. In other words, the thing...
But Kant still thinks there must be a... I mean, the question is, again, whether the... if you say there's no mind-independent entity, then even if you say we all have the same cognitive faculties, what coordinates your and my experience? Why should it be that we walk into the same room and see the same thing and blah, blah, blah?
He thinks there is a sense of mind independence, but it's not sort of outside any potential experience mind independence. It's the same way that we say in Kant's world of appearance, the objects of science are mind independent in that we all have the same perception of them. And for Kant, it's because we have similar mental faculties and construct them in the same way. James doesn't even want to theorize about that. It's just, this is what experience is like, that the pen that I see in front of me has aspects. This appearance of pen can be taken as part of two different series, he says in his essays in Radical Empiricism. It could be part of my mental life, right? I see this, I see that, now I see the pen. It could be part of its continued existence as a physical object. The pen is here, the pen is fallen on the ground, and then you can see the same pen and have one of the... So the analogy he gives is... A point can be part of two intersecting lines. If you say, oh, but no, which line is the point on? Well, it's on both. They just happen to cross in this instance. And that's the analogy he gives for how... So he has an essay called How Two Minds Can Know One Thing, and it amounts to something like that. Anyway, just to mention that...
Can I comment? Let me read one section from actual pragmatism lectures. The most fateful point of difference between being a rationalist and being a pragmatist is now fully in sight. Experience is in mutation, and our psychological ascertainments of truth are in mutation. So much rationalism will allow, but never that either reality itself or truth itself is mutable. Reality stands complete and ready-made from all eternity, rationalism insists, and the agreement of our ideas with it is that unique, unanalyzable virtue in them of which she has already told us. As that intrinsic excellence, their truth has nothing to do with our experiences. It adds nothing to the content of experience. It makes no difference to reality itself. It is supervenient, inert, static, a reflection merely. It doesn't exist. It holds or obtains. Mm-hmm. It belongs to another dimension from that of either facts or fact relations, belonging in short to the epistemological dimension. And with that big word, rationalism closes the discussion. The point he's trying to make is that rationalism grants you some sort of external reality, and then you get caught up in the context of epistemology when you talk about trying to match the agreement of your ideas with that external reality. And pragmatism says, yes, there's an external reality, but we create truth by the ways in which we have social agreement or what other verification processes that we employ around that reality. And it may or may not approximate what ultimately is quote-unquote there, but that is how we generate the truth.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, Mark, your way of putting it is important. The difference between saying something is independent of any possible experience, which is Kant's thing in itself, and then saying it's merely independent of some experiences, or it may be independent of our experiences, but it couldn't be independent of all possible experience, which is one of the better ways of putting mind independence and the pragmatist.
Right, it's the difference between transcendent, it transcends any given perception I'm having of it or that you're having of it, and transcendental, it exceeds all possible appearances.
Right.
I love those confusing, needlessly similar words.
Transplendent.
When we do the modern pragmatists, we'll see how they try and deal with these problems, because they're very much concerned with where it is that Peirce and James don't quite hold together, and they want to remedy that. So much of their... So we'll just... I mean, ultimately, we'll discuss all that.
We will give more cash value to this in the future. For next time, we will be reading Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Discourse on the Origin and Basis of Inequality Among Men, or the shorter version called The Discourse on Inequality. Please find a link for that on our website, partiallyexaminedlife.com. Please post some comments. Please go on iTunes and give us some good reviews. You can follow us on Twitter. There is a link to that. People have been discovering without us announcing it in any prior podcast on a regular basis. And, you know, believe what is useful to you.
I have a better idea. How about if they believe what's useful to me?
Yes. When you take power. Yes. Over the world.
I'll be a benevolent dictator.
See, as long as everyone believes. But
now that is interesting. So you could read James and read him for his idea that all these supposedly, seemingly a priori constructions of mine are actually cultural. And you could say, how can I make that work to my advantage? Can I make thought crime an a priori concept in the next generation of my country if I exert my dictatorial power enough?
Well, maybe I'm just preoccupied because I watched The Last King of Scotland the other day.
Ah, that is
some horrifying.
That is some nipple hooking goodness.
Yes. That being said, I was extremely disappointed. If anybody's still listening to this, and if it makes the cut, I will recommend that you see the documentary that was made, and I think it was like 1980 something or late 70s about Idi Amin, which was much better than this movie.
Okay.
My feeling.
Thank you, Dylan, again for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. Enjoyed it.
Thanks.
And we'll see you.
This was a good one.
We'll see you back with doing some Aristotle's metaphysics before too long, right?
Yeah, after that rousing endorsement of Aristotle that Dylan gave earlier, I think we definitely ought to have him back.
Your favorite.
for me to be the Aristotle's metaphysics expert? Wow. That's a new high.
We don't need experts for these things. We just need interested people that will give their attention to the material and have interesting things to say.
Yeah, this is kind of like the baseball team that doesn't win any team awards, doesn't make the playoffs. And I mean like, you know, like high school or junior high school. But they need to make sure that everybody gets their own trophy.
Ah.
So think of it that way.
I completely understand now.
Most improved, most enthusiastic.
Yeah, we'll send you your certificate of participation.
I'll frame it and put it on my wall.
That's right. Do they still do, I mean, not having kids, I don't know. Do they still do that where they're like constantly giving out little certificates and awards to kids for just showing up for things? And then you keep them and 20 years later you look back and remember. It's like, or is everything digital now? Does anybody not care anymore?
That has no effect on anything.
They receive an email.
They set up my son with a free email so they could email him an award.
Don't 10-year-olds have cell phones now? I mean, doesn't it?
Yeah, an award text.
Dylan, does Liam have an actual cell phone? Dylan, are you still there? He is lost.
Oh.
Well, that's fine. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Say your personalized good night to each and every. Do some shout outs.
Good night, Ishii.
Good night, John.
Good night.
Good night, Moon.
Good night, fuckwad.
Good night, God.
Did you read the review of us on iTunes that was like, they've gotten better because in the old episodes, there was a lot of more swearing and name calling, and it made my ears burn.
Yeah.
I'm truly not concerned about it. We have the label explicit. This is the way I speak. Sometimes I get excited about things.
Used to believe that I was pretty damn smart, and I still do, I guess. Oh, I know now that that has very limited uses, and it doesn't do much to keep me out of a mess. Used to believe that the free all in laws to think our way out of this EDC. And what I still know is a requisite to not be a Republican and only
must be some kind of force under the world. But that may be, I don't think it matters in the least. But damn it, you can stomach hate. Otherwise, what most of us are doing is work. And we will work, and we will work, and then come home to other work. And the illusion of vacation doesn't make you less a jerk. And if your leisure's a reaction to the sucking things upon you, so the time that you kick back in is spent kicking back the rest of time. What the hell could it possibly matter what you've got to say about it? You can talk about the system, but you're in it and you are it. Who cares? Who cares what you believe? Who cares? Just shut your arms and stagger where you please. What we think we might achieve is more stuff and still disease as we define ourselves in terms of something foreign.
You see that you live in it and your head is full of rocks.